underdeveloped. And this works to the benefit of these career politicians and to foreign interests instead of the interests of Peruvians. And so Pedro Castillo represented and still represents a move towards a new type of Peru, a Peru that is moving left and closer to a Peru for Peruvians themselves. And so this scares people that don't want that to be the reality because it doesn't benefit their pockets. Okay. And so that's why millions of Peruvians are out in the streets protecting and asking for his release.
Thank you for that. Arnold August, author and journalist from Montreal, a pleasure. And Libra Sankara, thank you. Contributor at the Troika Collective from Miami. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Batawe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 97 to 99 of chapter Nisan from the Holy Quran, recited by Hashim Rouhani.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innal ladhina توفاهم الملائكة ظالمي أنفسهم قالوا فيما كنتم قالوا كنا مستضعفين تضعفين في الأرض قالوا ألم تكن أرض الله واسعة فتهاجروا فيها فأولئك مأواهم جهنم وساءت مصيرا إلا المستضعفين من الرجال والنساء فَأُولَئِكَ عَسَى اللَّهُ أَنْ يَعْفُوَ عَنْهُمْ وَكَانَ اللَّهُ عَفُوًّا غَفُورًا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely as for those whom angels cause to die while they are unjust to their souls, they shall say, "In what state were you?" They shall say, "We were weak in the earth." They shall say, "Was not Allah's earth spacious, so that you should have migrated therein? So these it is whose abode is hell, and it is an evil resort. Except the weak from among the men and the children, who have not in their power the means, nor can they find a way to escape. So these, it may be, Allah will pardon them, and Allah is pardoning, forgiving." This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Press headlines. President Putin calls on the Russian defense industry to increase its weapon production to meet the needs of the army for the war in Ukraine. The U.S. House of Representatives approves a new $45 billion aid package for Ukraine. This will bring Washington's aid to Kiev to almost $100 billion. Also ahead, airlines cancel thousands of flights in the U.S. as a massive winter storm disrupts airport operations. Just past 8:30 a.m. in the Iranian capital, Tehran, you're watching Press TV's World News. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Russia's president urges the country's defense industry to increase its production to meet the needs of forces fighting in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin has told the industry's chiefs to make sure that the army receives the military equipment in the shortest possible time. He made the remarks during a visit to a weapon manufacturing center. Putin also said the industry should improve the technical quality of the equipment. This comes as Western countries, especially the U.S., have been supplying Ukraine with billions of dollars worth of advanced weapons since the beginning of the war in February. The U.S. House of Representatives, meanwhile, has approved a $45 billion aid package for Ukraine. The military and economic assistance is part of a $1.6 trillion government funding bill that has passed the Senate. It will now go to U.S. President Joe Biden to be signed into law. The U.S. has been Ukraine's main military sponsor in the war with Russia. It has already sent aid worth around $50 billion to Ukraine this year. Russia has repeatedly warned that foreign military aid for Ukraine will only drag out the war and escalate the human suffering. The war in Ukraine has plunged the Moscow-Washington ties to their lowest point in decades. Russia's ambassador to the U.S. has compared the state of the relations to an ice age, warning of the high risk of a clash.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has visited Washington in a much-publicized visit to the U.S. This is the first foreign visit that Zelensky has made to the U.S. since the war began back in February. During a meeting at the White House, President Joe Biden pledged to give more military support to Ukraine, including a new missile system.
As I said, Mr. President, you don't have to worry. We are staying with Ukraine as long as Ukraine is there. Thank you all.
The U.S. pledged $1.85 billion in military aid for Ukraine, including a Patriot missile system. Ukrainian officials have continuously called on the U.S. to deliver that system. Biden said the U.S. and Ukraine would continue to project a, quote, united defense against Russia as the war drags on. And as expected, the visit has drawn an angry response from Russia. Moscow's envoy to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, has denounced the visit as a, quote, Hollywood-style trip, accusing Washington of throwing all of its colossal resources, weapons, and intelligence capabilities at Kiev. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said that there had been no signs of readiness for peace talks during Zelensky's visit. He further noted that this was evidence that the U.S. was fighting a proxy war with Russia, quote, to the last Ukrainian. The Pentagon has disclosed that the U.S. has sent $20 billion worth of military aid to Ukraine in 2022. The recent $1.7 trillion federal spending bill includes $45 billion that's earmarked for Ukraine in 2023. Russia's defense minister Sergei Shoigu noted earlier that Kiev had already received more than $97 billion worth of weapons and ammunition, and that Russia was already fighting the entire West and NATO.
So the U.S. continues to supply Ukraine with arms and military equipment, despite growing calls from some Republican congressmen for more scrutiny over aid delivered to Kiev. Some polls also suggest the support for the U.S. backing of the war in Ukraine is waning.
As the West, spearheaded by the U.S., continues to pour more military and economic aid packages to Ukraine, there are now calls for more transparency. In the U.S., Republicans are calling for plans to exercise oversight powers to scrutinize tens of billions of dollars that the U.S. has spent. Republicans have been more skeptical than their Democratic counterparts in the Senate about funding Ukraine's defenses. Some Republicans have cited corruption in Ukraine, saying that there are concerns about the aid going to the country. Prior to the Ukrainian president's remarks, a few Republicans had already made public their opposition to the spending bill and further aid to Ukraine. We should be focused on trying to contain the war, not expand the war. And this sends the message that we are kind of okay with expanding the war. And I think we should be sending a different message, is what Warren Davidson, a Republican congressman, has said. Another Republican congressman, Matthew Gaetz, has criticized Zelensky, saying that American politicians who indulge his requests are unwilling to put Ukraine first.
You've got Americans here at home that are demanding accountability on our southwest border. You've got crime rampant. You've got historic inflation. You have a litany of issues that we all are paying for at the behest of this administration. And no one can tell us where this money's going. My heart breaks for the Ukrainians, absolutely. But every American deserves to know where every single dollar has gone.
This comes amid a declining support of Republican voters for more military aid to Ukraine. In the latest poll, 33% of Republicans agreed with prolonged support compared to 61% of Democrats and 46% of independents.
And turning elsewhere, Russia's foreign minister has called for de-escalation in the Nagorno-Karabakh region. That's after the only link between the region and Armenia was blocked by a group of Azerbaijani activists. Lavrov says he hopes that movement along the key road will be restored as soon as possible. He made the remarks following talks with his Azerbaijani counterpart in Moscow. The corridor, which is a key supply route for food, medicine and fuel, has been obstructed since last week by a group styling itself as environmental activists. Armenia says they are backed by the Azerbaijani government to create a humanitarian crisis in the mountainous enclave. Baku, however, accuses Russian peacekeepers of closing the road link. The Azerbaijan Republic regained control of the disputed region after a 2021 war with Armenia. From nurses to teachers to railway employees, British workers in various sectors have been staging back-to-back walkouts since the summer, and now air travelers in the country are warned of delays as passport control staff go on strike ahead of Christmas. The Public and Commercial Services Union says over 1,000 Border Force staff walked out of their jobs on Friday. This is the first day of their industrial action, which is due to last until New Year, as they are dissatisfied with their pay, demanding raises. According to the union, the government's 2% raise offer doesn't keep pace with a double-digit inflation in the country. the industrial unrest is expected to upend travel plans in the coming days. Britain's busiest airport, Heathrow, says passengers should be prepared for travel disruptions. The UK is reeling from strikes over pay and working conditions, and that's amid a cost of living crisis combined by fears of a recession.
2022 has been dominated by a cost of living crisis, and the figures are staggering. Inflation is running at a double-digit pace, the highest in 40 years, and far outpacing wage growth. While food prices have shot up almost 20%, and the cost of heating a typical home has jumped more than 150%. As temperatures plummet below zero and desperation rises, key sector worker unions have launched mass strike actions to pressure the government to force wage rises.
The people who are out here on strike today are the same people who not only worked through the pandemic, we worked for the people, we'd get their prescriptions, we'd get their milk and bread.
We just want a pay rise in line with the cost of living. At the moment, what we're getting is actually terms of a pay cut. So it's not even in line with inflation. Everything's gone up. We're just like everybody else. We're all struggling.
This is not about pay. This is about our jobs.
The situation has become so dire in Britain that many families will have to choose whether to heat their homes or feed their families this Christmas.
It is very distressing. It's a situation which, in a way, unimaginable for a country which is supposed to be one of the richest countries in Europe and in the West. Why is it we have these extremes of poverty? Why are people, some people, forced to choose between heating and eating? I mean, there's something completely wrong about our system. We should be plugging and supporting and promoting equality and, not oppressing the poor. You know, there's something which says a lot about our political system, which is flawed.
The government has pinned much of the blame on economic recovery from the COVID era. However, critics say its ruling Conservative Party incompetence and leadership instability that has also left the economy in a dire state. A lesser discussed reason for a European-wide crisis is the ongoing Ukraine war. Britain has remained a staunch supporter of continued fighting, even upping its shipments of arms and financial support.
I think the first is ensuring that we deliver more military aid and that military aid evolves to meet the situation that we're now facing. And that means more air defence systems, it means artillery, it means armoured vehicles. For our part in the United Kingdom, we've pledged to match or exceed the £2.3 billion in aid that we provided this year, next year.
Low wages, higher fuel costs, inflation and major strike action have all marred 2022. Does the government have what it takes to resolve these many issues in 2023? Probably not. It's going to be a long road with most likely higher taxation, major cuts in public spending and renewed pressure on an already struggling British working class. Robert Carter, London.
Now, police have clashed with protesters in the French capital, Paris, after a deadly shooting with a suspected racist motive on a Kurdish centre. Protesters gathered near the site of the shooting, hurling stones at the police. Security forces fired tear gas and attempted to disperse the crowd. French President Emmanuel Macron called the shooting an odious attack. The Interior Minister has reinforced police protection of Kurdish community sites in Paris and elsewhere across the country. A 69-year-old has been arrested in connection with the shooting, which killed three people and injured three others. The suspect was known to authorities and had a history of racism and attacks on foreign nationals, especially the Kurds. Thousands of flights have been cancelled in the US as a massive winter storm brings airport operations down to a crawl. Nearly 7,000 flights were cancelled on Friday and Thursday, leaving holiday travelers frustrated. The Federal Aviation Administration imposed ground stops and delays to de-ice a number of airport runways. as a result of these storms. Some 4,000 US flights were also delayed on Friday. Poor weather conditions have also disrupted railroad travel in the holiday season, forcing the cancellation of dozens of trains. Now, Japan's decision to boost its military spending has drawn strong rebukes from civic leaders in South Korea. Tokyo argues its move to build up its forces comes amid threats from North Korea and China. Tokyo's arms purchases will also provide a boon for U.S. weapons producers. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Palestinian resistance movements Hamas and Islamic Jihad have slammed the Israeli killing of a young Palestinian man near Tel Aviv. Islamic Jihad pledged that Israeli crimes would never undermine the determination of the Palestinian people to liberate their country. Hamas also emphasized that Palestinian resistance would continue and even escalate until the end of the Israeli occupation and the establishment of a Palestinian state with Al-Quds as its capital. Israeli forces shot dead Naim Badr in the town of Kafr Qasim on Friday. They allege he carried out a car ramming attack, injuring three Israeli troops. The latest killing comes amid heightened tensions between Israeli forces and Palestinians, in particular in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have killed over 220 Palestinians in the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip since the beginning of this year. That brings an end to our international bulletin for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah,
words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
In September, the U.S. created a foundation that was supposed to unfreeze Afghanistan's foreign assets. Yet, interviews with trustees reveal that, in 3 months, no funds have been disbursed. No concrete plans have been made to help the Afghan people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, "The Taliban seized power in Afghanistan in August 2021, and in response, Europe, the UAE, and the US froze the Afghan central bank's roughly $9 billion in foreign assets, $7 billion of which was under control of the US regime. Without access to these funds, alongside a lattice of sanctions, a decline in humanitarian aid, and harsh political turmoil under Taliban, Afghanistan has been led into an economic collapse with a dramatic uptick in poverty. 6 million Afghans are facing the immediate risk of starvation. According to calculations from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR, a left-leaning think tank, U.S. sanctions on Afghanistan, including the freezing of these central bank assets, could kill more people than 20 years of U.S. war and occupation." In
In September, the Biden administration placed half of the U.S.-controlled assets into a private foundation, trusted by just four people, to be used for the benefit of the people of Afghanistan while keeping them out of the hands of malign actors, according to a joint statement from the Departments of Treasury and State. But interviews with two of those four trustees revealed that no funds have yet been disbursed to help Afghan people, and there are no policies in place to do so immediately. One trustee underscored that it is unlikely the foundation will be a vehicle to quickly return the assets to Afghanistan's central bank while the Taliban is maintaining oppressive rule. This lack of progress raises concerns that the Biden administration is on course to worsen the rapidly spiraling humanitarian crisis. Who pays the price, asks Basir Bita, an Afghan activist who works with the Afghan refugee community in Canada and who has family in Afghanistan. For the U.S. freezing the funds, the public, the people who live in Afghanistan. The U.S. regime froze the Afghan central bank's assets amid public outcry over the U.S. military's withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Biden administration depicted the move as a refusal to legitimize Taliban rule. Yet, according to Andres Arroz, a senior research fellow at the CEPR, the reality is that central banks don't just hold government money. They also and mostly hold commercial banks' money. They're not only banks of governments, they're also banks of banks. It was important for the working of Afghanistan's financial system and therefore its economy that their banks have access to money that was seized by the U.S. The freezing of the assets plunged Afghanistan into a liquidity crisis in which people are unable to access their cash and perform essential transactions. Alongside the liquidity crisis is hyperinflation, which has worsened the acute and widespread problem of hunger. Between June 2021 and July 2022, the price of wheat flour in Afghanistan skyrocketed 68% and cooking oil jumped 55%, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross. 70% of homes are unable to meet basic food and non-food needs. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies warned in June. Reports have emerged of Afghans selling their daughters, their kidneys, in effort to survive hunger and rising debt. Citing the deepening catastrophe, some activists and lawmakers have been calling for the Biden administration to take a less collectively punitive approach and return the assets to Afghanistan's central bank. In January, the New York Times editorial board published an op-ed warning against the policy of letting the Afghan central bank fall apart, titled, "Let Innocent Afghans Have Their Money." In the midst of all of this, in February, the Biden administration issued an executive order to set aside $3.5 billion of the U.S.-held central bank assets for victims of the attacks of September 11, 2001, though lawmakers and lobbyists stand to profit handsomely. This move was widely criticized by UN experts and some 9/11 families for its disastrous humanitarian consequences for Afghans. On September 14th, the U.S. Departments of Treasury and State announced the other half of the U.S.-controlled reserves of the Afghan Central Bank. Another $3.5 billion would be placed under the control of a Swiss foundation called the Afghan Fund. The Afghan Fund would maintain its account with the Bank for International Settlements, which is a global financial institution based in Switzerland that provides banking services for central banks. Afghan men carrying a sack of flour in January, as the UN World Food Program distributes monthly food rations in an area south of Kabul. Between June 2021 and July 2022, the price of wheat flour in Afghanistan skyrocketed 68%. According to a statement from the Bank of International Settlements, its role is limited to providing banking services and it plays no part in decision-making of the Afghan Fund. In the short term, the Afghan Fund's Board of Trustees will have the ability to authorize targeted disbursements to promote monetary and macroeconomic stability and benefit the Afghan people. According to the joint statement from Treasury and State, the foundation could, for example, use the assets to pay for critical imports like electricity or to pay for Afghanistan's arrears at international financial institutions to preserve their eligibility for financial support. The Afghan Fund's long-term goal is to return the funds to the Afghan Central Bank, but only if key assets and counterterrorism controls are implemented, the statement indicates. Some activists and members of the U.S. Congress cautiously supported the creation of the Afghan Fund, hoping it marked a step forward to the United States on freezing the assets. The fund has the potential to create a vital pathway to a functioning financial system, returning desperately needed assets to Afghanistan that could alleviate major price spikes of food and other essentials. Representative Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, wrote in a September 15th statement. The press coverage surrounding the Afghan Fund intimated a major unlocking of the assets could be just around the corner. Setting up the new fund will enable the funds to flow quickly, Kylie Atwood wrote for CNN. But now, 3 months later, no money has been distributed, and two of the Afghan Fund's trustees say there is no immediate plan to return assets to the Afghan Central Bank.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran and Saudi Arabia in the world of politics.
Part 1.
In recent years, Saudi Arabia has been the largest buyer of arms in the world and is making great efforts to continue on its path. At the same time, it is trying to start a coalition of its friends, especially the Arab countries, against Iran.
Talk is cheap. Let's look at the actions. Saudis helped Saddam Hussein for 8 years. Saudis helped Al-Qaeda. Saudis created Daesh. Saudis created a Nusra. So they started this sectarian message, not us.
Nonsense. The Iranians are the ones who are exporting terrorism. They're the ones who are stoking the fires of sectarianism. They're the ones who are violating international laws and norms and acceptable behavior. And they are the ones who have been on an aggressive path since 1979.
Despite the fact that the United States and almost every other powerful nation supports Saudi Arabia actively and tries to undermine us actively, we are still the most influential power in the Middle East. That should tell you something. That should tell you that we have made the right choices and they've made the wrong choices.
The end of World War I was an era of reform in the world of politics. It was no longer like the days before the war, and the following years were the beginning of a new era for geographical maps. New rulers, one after another, could find their place in the world of politics. In Iran, it was Reza Shah's turn. At the same time that Reza Shah came to power in Iran, Abdul Aziz bin Saud, relying on his bloodthirsty and ruthless army called Ikhwan, who were staunch followers of Wahhabism, was able to dominate all of Saudi Arabia after defeating Sharif Hussein, the ruler of Mecca. Shortly afterwards, he established the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia called Hejaz and Najd and its annexes. At this time, Abdul Aziz was seeking legitimacy out of the borders of which the Islamic countries, especially Iran, were the most important. However, due to the horrific news of the brutality of Abdul Aziz's forces and the conquest of Hejaz, many Islamic countries, including Iran, refused to send their caravans for the Hajj. This decision became more serious when the Iranian envoy to Hejaz, Habibullah Hoveida, who had gone there on October 7, 1925, sent a report to Iran about Saudis' insults to the holy places. Hoveida's report to Tehran was influential in Iran's subsequent decisions. Iran, like many Islamic countries, on October 7th of 1925, officially emphasized the ban on sending pilgrims to Hajj. The Prime Minister said in a statement to the Foreign Ministry, "It is essential to inform the public that the government is concerned about the safety and well-being of pilgrims during the Hajj and recommends that they refrain from performing the Hajj this year." The new rulers of Mecca were seeking legitimacy during these years and desperately needed to be recognized by their neighbors. A few years later, on the anniversary of Reza Shah's reign, Saudi King Abdul Aziz bin Saud sent him a congratulatory message. In response, on July 1st of 1928, Habibullah Hoveida was sent to Hejaz as Iran's representative so that Iran could officially begin its ties with the Saudi dynasty. At the beginning of the talks between Pahlavi and Saudi dynasties, the Iranians set conditions for recognizing the Hejaz government, including repairing the shrines of the Imams in the Baghi, religious freedom of the Shias, leaving the judgment of the Iranian pilgrims to Iranian officials, changing hand-cutting and beheading to other punishments, and delivering the belongings of deceased Iranian pilgrims to Iranian agents. However, this request was rejected unless the Pahlavi regime recognized the Saudi king. A year after these measures and on June the 23rd of 1929, the Saudis sent a group to Iran to negotiate and sign a contract. Negotiations were successful. On August the 13th of 1929, Iran sent a letter to the Saudi delegation stating its recognition of the Hejaz government. "We are pleased to announce that today the Imperial Government of Iran recognizes the Hejaz and Najd government, and a telegram has been sent from the Prime Minister to the Foreign Ministry of Hejaz and Najd." During the years after these negotiations, the most important issue between the two countries was performing the Hajj and organizing the sending of Iranian pilgrims to Hejaz. It continued until 1944, when a young man named Abu Talib Yazdi and his wife decided to travel to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj. During the Tawaf, this 22-year-old man got sick in the heat of the sun and vomited. Urged by some pilgrims, Saudi officers accused him of vomiting deliberately. Abu Talib was arrested and the judge sentenced him with beheading. The sentence was carried out in public. As the bitter news of Yazdi's beheading reached Iran, a wave of protest began in the country. On January the 18th of 1944, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Iran issued a statement and sent a letter to Saudi Arabia condemning this act. In the following days, many articles condemning this act and asking the government to protest Saudi Arabia were published in newspapers. Iran did not find the Saudi government's response to the incident convincing and sent another letter of protest to Saudi Arabia on February the 7th. Following this incident, Iran demanded an apology from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and threatened to sever ties. Even in response to King Abdul Aziz's congratulatory letter in Nowruz of 1944, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi called for a friendly solution to this matter. Once again, the Saudi king reiterated the legality of beheading an Iranian pilgrim and its compliance with the Islamic law. As the issue continued, Iran severed ties with Saudi Arabia and chose Iraq to protect Iran's interests in Saudi Arabia. The lack of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia continued in the next 5 years until King Abdul Aziz sent a letter to Iranian King Mohammad Reza Pahlavi on the subject of cooperation of Islamic nations. In the letter, he also expressed his desire to establish relations between the two countries. Following these letters and with the sending of ambassadors, political relations resumed in 1948 and the issue of Hajj was on the agenda. The Saudi embassy in Tehran announced that it would do its utmost to ensure the security of Iranian pilgrims. After the 1953 Iranian coup d'etat and the return of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi to the country, he met with King Saud on his first visit to Saudi Arabia in March of 1957, and the relations between the two countries entered a new phase. The relations that U.S. President Eisenhower called Twin Pillars Policy of the United States in the Persian Gulf region. According to this strategy, Iran and Saudi Arabia, as regional powers, had the responsibility to provide security in the Persian Gulf in favor of the United States and align their policies with that of the U.S. in the Middle East. The common interests between the two kings brought them closer day by day, the most important factor of which was the rise of Arab nationalism in the countries of the region. During the Cold War, the Arab countries went through turbulent years. That was also known as the Arab Cold War. The nationalization of the Suez Canal at the beginning of Gamal Abdel Nasser's rise to power made him a popular politician in the Arab world and Islamic countries. The expansion of Nasser's policies is the starting point for cooperation between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the two countries whose mission is now only one thing: preventing the spread of leftist thinking in their own countries as well as in the region. In 1958, General Abdul Karim Qasim staged a coup in Iraq. It resulted in overthrowing the monarchy and establishing a republic in the country, a coup that worried both the monarchies of Iran and Saudi Arabia. Qasim was the first head of government in Iraq who claimed that the two Iranian cities of Khorramshahr and Abadan belonged to Iraq. His government also had a clear interest in the Soviet Union. These positions were good reasons for Iran and Saudi Arabia to become closer to one another and become enemies of Iraq. But one of the most important examples of military cooperation between Iran and Saudi Arabia was in Yemen in the early 1960s. The coup d'etat of the Yemeni leftist colonels on September the 26th of 1962 against the king, with the aim of establishing the Arab Republic of Yemen, was opposed by Iran and Saudi Arabia. The two countries assisted pro-monarchy forces. The Iranian army, with the help of Saudi Arabia, transferred Yemeni soldiers loyal to the monarchy to bases in Iran and trained them in military techniques. This cooperation was the culmination of the political and security relations between Tehran and Riyadh that involved Iran in the conflicts of the Arab world in the region known as the Arab Cold War, and eventually pushed countries such as Egypt, Syria, and Iraq against Iran. In 1964, King Saud, the second king of Saudi Arabia, died at the age of 67, and his crown prince, King Faisal, came to power. The new king of Saudi Arabia traveled to Iran on his first foreign trip in 1964. Following this visit, the Iran-Saudi Arabia Friendship Association was founded under the chairmanship of the then Prime Minister of Iran, Amir Abbas Hoveida, and bilateral relations expanded from the political and economic spheres to scientific and cultural issues. A few years later, in 1973, Saudi students received scholarships in some fields, including law and medicine in Iran, as Tehran signed a contract to establish a medical college in Riyadh. The reign of King Faisal, the third king of Saudi Arabia, was a golden age in relations between the Saudi and Pahlavi monarchies. Receiving the official invitation of King Faisal, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi traveled to Saudi Arabia for the second time in November of 1968. Despite the many differences between the two kings, especially over some issues in the Persian Gulf, many factors brought them closer in this era. The Najdi Ardah dance of Salman bin Abdulaziz, who would become the king of Saudi Arabia a few decades later, before Mohammad Reza Pahlavi on this trip, is a sign of the close relationship between the two kings during those years. The Dhofar War is Iran's most famous presence in a regional conflict back then, a war that started in Yemen. In 1966, a socialist regime came to power via a coup in South Yemen. The regime demanded the total liberation of the Arabian Peninsula from foreign domination. It also supported leftist guerrilla movements in Saudi Arabia and Oman. Because of this, a war began between these leftist guerrillas and the Kingdom of Oman in Dhofar province. From the point of view of both the Pahlavi and Saudi monarchies, this guerrilla movement was interpreted as a Soviet Union attempt to infiltrate the Persian Gulf, and therefore they supported the Kingdom of Oman. Iran sent about 20,000 troops to Oman in this war, and in total, the main burden of the war against the Dhofar guerrilla forces fell on Iran. Consequently, a brigade of Iranian forces established a permanent base in Oman in 1973. The continuation of this presence resulted in the defeat of Dhofar forces in 1974. At the same time, Saudi Arabia was providing financial support to the ruler of Oman in this conflict. Oil has always played a decisive role in Iran-Saudi Arabia relations. But one of the most important turning points in this story is the Yom Kippur War between Egypt and Israel in 1973, which led to an oil shock back then. What connected this war to Iran-Saudi Arabia ties was the request of the oil-exporting Arab countries to support Egypt and Syria, the support that was going to happen with the oil embargo. By forming a coalition of oil-producing Arab countries, Saudi Arabia imposed unprecedented sanctions on Western countries which supported Israel in the war. The sanctions pushed oil prices from $3 per barrel to $12. Iranian officials said they had opposed the use of oil as a political weapon and had considered it an economic commodity. In response, Saudi Arabia accused Iran of supporting the West. Months later, oil prices went up. Saudi Arabia insisted that continuing to raise prices could hurt the global economy and oil prices should fall, but Iran insisted on keeping the prices high. Then it was Iran that accused Saudi Arabia of supporting the West. Through Saudi Arabia, the U.S. tried to force Iran to reduce oil prices, and in this regard, contacts and meetings were held between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but neither of them decreased oil prices. In contrast, to satisfy the Americans, Saudi Arabia increased its oil production from 8.3 to 10 million barrels per day. The increase in production, which eventually led to a drop in oil prices, made the Iranian king criticize Saudi Arabia.
This year's record-breaking global displacement crisis calls for immigration policies that reflect humanity, not cruelty. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, "This year had the unwelcome distinction of being the first to see over 100 million people displaced worldwide. Such a staggering milestone reminds us that greater efforts are needed to address the underlying causes forcing so many innocent people to flee their homes. Even more alarming, this milestone was reached by the middle of the year. Over 50 million people were internally displaced within their own countries. Over 30 million were refugees forced to flee their countries, and some 4.3 million were stateless. More than 70% of all refugees came from five countries mired in violent conflict. Climate-related emergencies, meanwhile, including severe floods in Pakistan and drought in Somalia, contributed heavily to the growing number of people internally displaced. Many countries have welcomed refugees this year, despite seismic challenges and limited resources." Far too often, states adopt double standards in their treatment of refugees and asylum seekers. Such compassion in the face of enduring struggles is encouraging and should extend to all crises. Refugees have also remained resilient while confronting these obstacles, which speaks to their inspiring grit and bravery that rarely makes the news. But far too often, states adopt double standards in their treatment of refugees and asylum seekers. This is especially true for Haitians, who have long encountered discriminatory U.S. immigration policies and abuse, exemplified by images of U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback whipping desperate Haitian asylum seekers in Del Rio, Texas, last year. Between October 2018 and June 2021, the U.S. denied asylum to Haitians more than any other nationality. After decades of political and economic turmoil, living conditions in Haiti deteriorated this year due to gang violence following 2021 assassination of then-president Jovenel Moïse. Nearly half the country faces acute hunger. A lack of safe drinking water and basic sanitation have also led to a rapid re-emergence of cholera. As a result, many Haitians have had to flee their country, which prompted the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, to call on all countries to stand in solidarity with Haiti and not to return Haitians to a country that is extremely fragile. Unfortunately, the U.S. regime accelerated the mass expulsion of more than 25,000 Haitians between September 2021 and May 2022. They were returned to Haiti, where they face likely harm and humanitarian disaster. Most of the expulsions have been carried out under Title 42, a rarely used provision of U.S. health law first invoked by President Trump and continued under President Biden to bar people from seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border under the pretext of preventing COVID-19. By denying Haitians and others the right to seek asylum, this use of Title 42 blatantly violates both international and U.S. law. It's discrimination masquerading as a public health policy, and it's only created more chaos at the border. We'll be right back. According to reports and official data, in November, a federal judge's ruling confirmed as much by striking down Title 42, although what happens next remains to be seen. In another step forward, Biden recently extended temporary protected status for Haitians already in the U.S. The U.S. regime has long served as a safe haven for the persecuted, but it must do more to treat all asylum seekers with respect and allow them to fully access the asylum process. The disparate treatment of refugees and asylum seekers also emphasizes the larger need for a more efficient, just, and inclusive U.S. immigration system. This year's record-breaking global displacement crisis calls for greater protections and investment by the international community instead of more indifference and cruelty. It demands humane policies anchored in respect and dignity for all people.
This is IRIB English Radio.